Hi, I'm Jim Grusin.
And hi, I'm Will Leach. And this is the Grusin Leach Podcast, episode 65 here at the New Republic. This podcast, Grusin, can finally start collecting Social Security. Actually, no, I think that's like 20 years ago that you could collect Social Security at 65. By the time we reach the age of Social Security, I assume, well, we'll have all died in the nuclear holocaust. That actually may happen in a couple of weeks. How's it going, Grusin?
Yeah, tune in to the podcast next week. It may not be here. Yeah, when you're 65, you can get the discounts at movie theaters. Or is it 55 now? I feel like I actually see.
I think it's 55. My mother is always proudly noting the... That's a strange thing as they get older. I don't know if I'm going to do that, but when my parents can use the senior citizen discount, they actually love to tell me about it and are quite proud.
Yeah, I held on to my college student ID for quite some time after I graduated, just because I enjoyed using the discounts.
It's cool to be a college student. It is not cool to be old.
Hey, man, haven't you seen those AARP TV ads? Those people look pretty rockin'.
Grusin Leach Podcast, as always, we remind you to find us on SoundCloud, newrepublic.com. Email us, grusinleach@newrepublic.com. Also, I want to start emphasizing to people that you can go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP, and you can find links to every single movie we have talked about on this podcast since it began. Of course, if you go to the SoundCloud page, it will actually tell you the exact time that we start talking about each movie. So if you're like, hey, I loved what they had to say about Free Fire this week, let's see what they had to say about other movies. You can just go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP or go to GriersonLeach.com and just click on podcast. And you can see every movie we've talked about in this podcast. Of course, email us GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com and make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a nice review on iTunes. And if you do and list the name of a movie you would like us to talk about, we will review it in our reboot section. Our first reboot movie this week comes to us from... Just Give Me the Reboot. Important in the Anarchy, 4 stars, writes Just Give Me the Reboot. Fantastic podcast. Though I usually find myself not always agreeing with Grusin, I respect his opinion. Leach is always right, though. I like this guy. As a film student at USC, oh, that's awesome. There's a film student like Tim Grusin. Just Give Me the Reboot is a film student at USC. You are, of course, a former film student at USC. And just so you know, they're obviously teaching them better now than they did when you were there.
He only gave us 4 stars, though. So wait, am I the person that kept us from 5 stars? I'm sorry. Will. I apologize. I'll do better next time.
Just try to be always right. As a film student at USC, I really appreciate their insight into film and their appreciation for the art form in general. For my reboot, recently in a class we were discussing the media in film. Did you study media in film when you were a film student at USC, Grusin?
Yeah, I suppose we did. Yeah.
Oh, well. Recently in class we were discussing the media in film, and obvious answers came up like Nightcrawler and All the President's Men. But no one I know of mentioned one of my all-time favorite movies, Sidney Lumet's Network. I would love to hear your take on the increasingly prescient and applicable movie and how it's moved on across time from a dark comedy to a straight-up drama. So our first reboot movie, it will be Network. Our second reboot movie comes to us from New Jersey J. Excellent content, genuine chemistry, New Jersey J says. I was a regular reader of GNL's old column on Deadspin, was glad to recently discover this pod. Being familiar with their column, the excellent content was not a surprise. What I was happy to see, however, is that their genuine, easy chemistry on air. Aside, I listen to the many, many podcasts, and the best of them share this trait. Effectively Wild, Greenwald, Ryan, Smodcast. I suggest the new listeners scroll through titles they recognize to sample the show, or go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP and then move on to new episodes. This worked well for me. My request for the weekly reboot is The Royal Tenenbaum. So our second movie we will be discussing in our reboot section is The Royal Tenenbaum. All right, so our first movie we're going to review this week, our one new movie we'll be discussing is Free Fire.
So, what do you say we check out the merch?
Mouse, come out wherever you are.
Is that what we ordered?
You're Ilbertrude, eh? Chipping the bird there.
He says it's not what he ordered.
They ordered M16s?
Really? I'm not running a pizza delivery service.
Free Fire is the new film from director Ben Wheatley, who directed High Rise. He directed Kill List and Sightseers. It stars... a bunch of different people, but I guess maybe the primary star is Brie Larson, who is an American in the 1970s in Boston who has helped put together a black market arms deal between the IRA and a South African gun smuggler, played by one of Will's favorite actors, Charlton Copley. In the ensemble is sort of a smooth-talking, well-dressed American named Army, played by Armie Hammer. Cillian Murphy is part of the IRA. You also have people like Sam Riley in the cast. They meet up in an abandoned warehouse to do this black market deal. Tensions are high kind of from the beginning, partly because the guns that Murphy wanted end up being not the guns that are actually delivered at the day of the purchase. And then what we discover is that one lackey on one side of the deal knows somebody on the other side of the deal. Something happened with the guy's cousin. They come to blows because everybody is strapped. Gunfire is exchanged. And what you then have is a 90-minute movie, about an hour's worth of just shoot 'em up back and forth, everybody holed up in the warehouse. I've seen this movie twice now. I saw it for the first time at the Toronto Film Festival, which was back in September. And it's been a while since I saw it, so I kind of wanted to see it again to sort of refresh my memory. I reviewed it for us for the New Republic, and I had some colleagues who were at this screening with me this last week, and I told them that, and they said, what was there to remember? There's not a lot of plot in this movie, and there's not much, I would say, in terms of character development or even sort of rooting interest in this film. It really is kind of a cinematic exercise, and can you sustain one of the sort of foundational things that movies do, which are action sequences or people shooting each other? Can you make a whole movie out of just people shooting each other? And my answer is just barely. I find this movie really interesting and watchable, but not necessarily great or even all that good. But I think people like Brie Larson bring a lot to it and help make it more interesting. The actual just sort of exercise of trying to make a whole movie out of this, I think, is both interesting but also is very limiting. It's not great. It's very diverting, and I liked it just barely enough to recommend.
Yeah, I'm not with you on this one. I find it, frankly, really tiresome. I have to tell you, if you're wondering whether, wow, is an hour long, and you're not really you're not like overstating that. It is literally the last hour of the movie is a non-stop shootout scene, of course. And you know, one of the jokes, such as it is that everyone, there's a funny, like, there's one like good laugh in the movie where one of the characters says, wait, is he on our side or is he not on our side? Because of this shooting becomes so chaotic and so kind of confusing that people forget who is fighting who and who's shooting who and so on. And that theoretically, again, as you talk about as an exercise, sounds theoretically interesting, but in practice, it's very, very repetitive and tiresome, I have to admit. I think that he does the best that he can to try to liven this up and to try to find different variations and different ways and to toss in new people and toss in new different things. And I get it. And I understand I appreciate the effort, I suppose, but there's just not enough for me to hang on to here. I have to say, none of these people are particularly interesting. I think almost by design, they almost feel they have that, you know, it's funny, we've talked a lot in this podcast about how the Tarantino knockoffs and the things that do it Din Vinny or Dead, the characters seem almost specifically designed like those kind of 90s scuzzball, unlikable, anti-hero people. Like, none of them really have a redeeming quality whatsoever. Brie Larson and Cillian Murphy are probably the closest that we have to likable, and that's really just because I think those are the two most charismatic actors in the cast. I like Armie Hammer. I think he's actually generally a very charismatic actor, but here he's just all smug snark in a way that I found, I don't know. The thing I like about Armie Hammer generally is this kind of open facedness and this kind of idea. There's a sincerity to him that even when he's playing a bad guy, for example, I still feel like that shines through. Here, the idea of Armie Hammer playing too cool for school, I don't think works. Also, Charlotte Copley. Can we talk about Charlotte Copley for just a moment? We've talked about Danny Houston being your guy. That you just like, Charlotte Copley is absolutely my guy. There is not a line reading that he can give that he cannot just crank up to an absolutely ridiculous, stupid level, taking you completely out of the movie whatsoever. And I feel like there's a lot of that in this. There's some good actors in this movie, but they all seem to be like desperately trying to find something to grasp onto. When what's funny is that I'm not sure, I think Wheatley kind of by design doesn't give them anything, which basically leads to just a lot of posing and a lot of rah, 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 talk. And there's just a lot of that in a way that I found not only not memorable, but pretty exhausting and definitely, as I said, quite tiresome.
Yeah, I feel like the example I always use in this situation is the remake of Ocean's 11 that Steven Soderbergh made about 15 years ago. And that movie, before any of us had had a chance to see it, very much like from watching the trailers, felt like, hey, we've got a lot of cool actors. Let's all just be cool together and just be like cool and stuff. And there is that fear of, oh my God, they're going to have way more fun making this movie than any of us will have watching it. And that movie turned out to be, I think, pretty great. Free Fire, I think, is what that worry was we have about a movie like Ocean's 11. It definitely feels like Ben Wheatley has encouraged everybody to enjoy their super 70s costumes and the super 70s vibe of the movie that they're going for, like this kind of, you know, B-movie genre, crime, thriller, comedy thing. You know, everybody has, like, bushy mustaches or, like, you know, John Denver's music is used as an ironic counterpoint to certain sequences in it. And the Tarantino thing is definitely, if this movie had come out in about 1995, it would have been like, oh, this Ben Wheatley guy is so trying to be like the next Tarantino. There's also like a Guy Ritchie element to it, because of course Guy Ritchie was sort of thought of as, especially at the beginning of his career, being kind of Tarantino-esque. And I acknowledge all of that. Those are all the clear problems of it. But I have to say, both times I've watched it, there was enough for me to hang on to. I think, because I did find it kind of interesting to see how they kind of navigate this space and how they kind of deal with it. I would never just say that it was like a hate watch or anything like that, but there's something that is appealingly scruffy and unlikable about a lot of the characters that I did actually enjoy watching them shoot each other and kind of get like, because as the movie goes along, not only are they shooting each other, they are getting hit on occasion. So people are all getting like bullet wounds and they're kind of like dragging around the warehouse and like that. And so I think if there's any kind of like thematic depth to this movie, which is a bit doubtful, the thematic depth is Ben Wheatley kind of creating this world of these kind of unlikable people who are just doing these things to each other kind of because they all deserve it, because they're all kind of cretins in their own way. That's not a way to make a great movie, but it's enough to make me at least kind of interested in what he's going for.
I think I would have enjoyed it more too, because I agree with you that like there is kind of fun. It is kind of funny that everybody gets shot a couple times. There's a cleverness, like that is kind of fun that everybody gets dinged up and everybody gets kind of nicked, and there's a clever notion to that. There's a certain chaotic nihilist thing that's fun. I just wish they were more entertainingly awful. Like, I don't, like, it's funny. This is, we dropped Tarantino a couple times, but even when Tarantino is not working, or even when we are frustrated with his worldview, where he's so insular and kind of in his own place, which this movie feels like, this definitely feels like a movie that, like, movie nerd, like, people that are really like read like film school rejects and stuff like that are going to love this movie. You know, like, I don't mean any offense to that side, but those kind of dudes, there's a certain kind of very dude, by the way, very bro kind of thing. We're like a fanboy movie. There's a really kind of insular fanboy notion to this movie that you see, you know, it's that kind of, you know, slam dance, that kind of, you know, the Fantastic Fest type of stuff. There's clearly a lot of that here, which is fine. I can dig on that vibe. I think that's kind of fun too. But even when Tarantino or even some other guys are doing that, this is a movie where people talk a lot, but don't really say anything that funny, don't really say anything that interesting. And so I feel like it really is just kind of this nihilism in a vacuum, in a way where I couldn't even get excited to be like, oh, I can't wait for that guy to get shot. That's going to be great. Because it just feels just kind of empty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm recommending the movie, and I still think of it as an empty exercise. I mean, I think there's no getting around kind of the hollowness of what this movie is. And, you know, Ben Wheatley is, you know, very much looked at as an up-and-coming filmmaker, I think, for a lot of people. I'm a little more mixed on him.
And, yeah, me too.
And I have to say that, like, the movie of his that I probably like the most, or I respond to the most, is in some ways not dissimilar, which is A Field in England, which was not widely seen. But it's also about, like, they're not trapped in a warehouse shooting each other, but there's something kind of small about the story, that there's something that feels kind of like bleak in its own kind of way. But I found that movie to be much more resonant than this one is. You know, it's not doing well at the box office. I'm not entirely surprised because it has relatively decent-sized stars in it, especially because Brie Larson was in Kong Skull Island. You know, even if you haven't seen her in Room, you might have seen her in that. But
or you know that she won an Oscar, for example.
Yeah. But so it's not like a thing where I think people could kind of grasp that this was kind of a pretty simple premise that's not so dazzlingly executed that people will go, oh, I gotta check that out.
Yeah. All right, so what'd you give it?
You can probably guess. I gave it a very low B minus.
Yeah, I gave it a C. It almost got down to C minus. I'm actively irritated. But I find the movie, because I thought, once I realized it was tiresome, I'm like, man, I'm going to be so pissed by the end of this movie. But it's really just so kind of callow that I couldn't even really get angry at it. So it ultimately kind of lands in C land. I got to say, just to kind of close on Wheatley, I haven't actually liked any of his movies. I have to say, for this kind of everybody's excited about, I like this more than High Rise, which I found deeply obnoxious and had absolutely nothing to say whatsoever, but was trying to. This really doesn't have anything to say, but isn't really trying to say anything. High Rise I found actively irritating. This I just didn't like. So, hey, that's an upgrade.
Congratulations, Mr. Wheatley.
Yes, yes. By the next movie, you'll find a movie that I won't want desperately to be over a quarter of the way in. All right, now it is time for our reboot section. Our first reboot movie this week is Network.
Cue Howard.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like at this moment to announce that I will be retiring from this program in 2 weeks' time because of poor ratings. Since this show was the only thing I had going for me in my life, I have decided to kill myself.
So what'd she say?
I'm going to blow my brains out right on this program a week from today.
Network came out in 1976. It was written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. And of course, it stars Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Robert Duvall, Ned Beatty, Beatrice Straight, who oddly won a Best Supporting Actress, which we will talk about in a moment. And of course, a posthumous Best Actor Oscar for Peter Finch, playing the newscaster who is as mad as hell. And I don't remember what he does after that. I feel like he's upset about it, but I don't know exactly how, if he's going to like keep dealing with it. I'm not really sure. I always forget the second line. Network is this takes place at this network where Peter Finch's character, Howard Beale, has been a longtime lion of broadcasting. Worked with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite and all of these people, but he's had a very difficult time in the recent of his life. He's lost his wife. He's become an alcoholic. He's very upset. He seems to be having some sort of breakdown. And he goes on air and kind of loses a little bit. Now, what's interesting about that is, A, nobody notices at first, which is a nice touch. And B, they start to realize, because they saw him as on his way out, they start to realize, including Faye Dunaway's character, who's this woman that's kind of the head of programming for the network, that people are listening, and there's a certain kind of, I believe, as she puts it exactly, the American people want someone to articulate their rage. This came out in 1976. I might add, the year after I was born. So thankfully, things are totally different now. So basically, she encourages him to continue being the star of this network. And eventually he has his "I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore" scene, which leads to people screaming out of their windows, and I think the most iconic moment of the film. Meanwhile, she is having an affair with William Holden. Robert Duvall is trying to run the network. Ned Beatty is a sponsors man who pops in and has a thundering great speech that was gleefully echoed in the first episode of Better Call Saul. And it's network. We've all heard about network many, many times. Now, Grierson, I've heard, it's funny, one of the things that, that we did a podcast a while back about, you know, movies in the age of Trump and movies that conjured up that time, that made us think of Trump and how it helped that put in context. And we didn't talk about network. And it's funny because network has come up a lot, particularly in the Trump age, particularly with the idea of a person who seems to be a little bit unhinged, but is appealing in this kind of unhinged, angry way via a relatively new medium on a global scale and gaining influence and power. And that part of network, I have to say, I think mostly holds up in ways that are sometimes a little eerie. I'll confess there are a couple of times where they seem to be talking exactly about this moment right now in a somewhat disturbing way. So that part, which is the part everyone remembers from network, I think holds up very, very well. A lot of other stuff, I'm kind of sad to say, doesn't. William Holden plays this old-time friend of Howard Beale's, who is the head of the news division. He is married to Beatrice Strait, and he somewhat inexplicably decides to have an affair with Faye Dunaway, and she somewhat inexplicably decides to have an affair with him, which leads to these kind of dark moments that probably read as very dark comedy at the time, but I have to say now seem very silly, where she is seducing him while talking about ratings and so on. And one of my issues with network now is a lot of the stuff that is clearly satire and read as dark satire, Lumet's not really that kind of director, and he keeps shoehorning, understandably, trying to shoehorn them in to this kind of human story, and their relationship really doesn't make a lot of sense and doesn't really work, and leads into, when you take away from that, you start to realize that the last half of the movie is basically just things that Paddy Chayefsky thinks and putting them in the mouths of his characters. And it's very entertaining. He's a lovely writer. He's fun to listen. It's fun to listen to great actors kind of read his stuff. But I'll say that this is a movie that I'll confess seems very, very proud of itself. And it has a lot of good stuff to say. And it has a lot of smart things to bring up that still have effects today. However, I was surprised how a lot of network left me a little cold, Grierson. Are you going to leave me hanging here, or are you with me at all?
Oh, not at all. This is one of those movies that I have wrestled with, I guess, for a long time because, you know, we grew up the time that we did, and if people tell you, like, these are the great movies, these are the great American movies of the 1970s that you need to see because they're great movies, network is always part of that conversation. And so, you know, I've seen it several times, you know, from about like the mid-90s on, I want to say, and I would kind of like revisit it every once in a while just because it never entirely clicked for me. So I go back and watch it again and sort of see if I missed something the first time and like that. And I feel the exact same way when I watched it this week for us, which is I think it's really entertaining, and I think it's really well written, and I think it's just kind of like this sort of crackerjack entertainment that kind of is kind of like bam, 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 and it works really well, and I think that Sidney Lumet's really sort of stripped-down style works really nicely for it. It's incredibly, incredibly watchable. I just don't buy a lot of it is the problem. And what I find, there are probably a couple things in discussing this movie that like are things that drive me crazy when other people say them, so forgive me. But if this movie came out now, I'm not sure if it would be lionized the way it is. I feel like it's been sent to us in terms of how we're supposed to feel about it. Because I think a lot of the stuff, and you touched on it, Will, there's a lot of show-offy stuff and a lot of yelling at us about what we're doing wrong as people and why we're not as smart as Paddy Chayefsky is that I feel like just doesn't fly anymore. You know, this is not a great comparison, but even like something like, say, Birdman or something like that, where it's like really showy and wants to kind of like preach something at the audience. Again, they're very different. This is more of a satire, though Birdman kind of is a satire. I just feel like Network is this movie that wants to make sure that you understand that television is terrible. And not only is television terrible, you're a terrible person because you've been watching television. But don't worry, because if you watch Network, you'll be cured of the thing that's made you a stupid, terrible, dumb person. And I mean, just the fact that now we live in this, you know, you mentioned Better Call Saul. We now live in this golden age of television, which how dare you say that now about television? But, you know, for the reboot, we did Quiz Show. We talked about Quiz Show and how that has a little bit of the TV bad, movies good thing. This movie really has it. And not only that, you talked about Beatrice Straight winning the Best Supporting Actress Oscar, which is kind of shocking. I think Faye Dunaway is a terrific actress, and especially after this year's Oscars, I have a lot of compassion for what she had to kind of go through in terms of presenting Best Picture. I think she's a really great actress. I so dislike that character, not the way that not her for playing it, but the way that character is constructed as such a don't you see the way chicks are, the way they're ruining everything?
You could almost see him going, but look at this ball breaker, huh? Like it's got a little bit of that, like I don't think, the way she plays it is fine, but that, like, the way they treat that character and the way they portray her is very old man cranky.
Yeah, I mean, the whole movie, I have to just jump in and say, feels very much like you darn millennials and you darn chicks. Of course, it was before the era of the millennials, but like if this movie came out now, it's basically like these kids are ruining everything. I mean, this whole movie is essentially like the right way to play baseball kind of argument. I mean, that's what this whole movie really is. It's about why don't these kids do it the way we did and respect us, even though we're older and times change and like that. And the movie has, I feel like, just not very much self-awareness of that fact. I completely agree. I can understand why. And by the way, just really fast, Faye Dunaway's character is named Diana Christensen, which is one of the great names in movies. All the characters, I think, have great names in this movie, but Diana Christensen, I especially love. It feels like a TV name in a great way. But I can see why she wants to have the affair with William Holden's character. I mean, other than the fact that she's young and attractive and blonde, which are not, those are factors that factor into affairs all the time. But the fact that he's so deeply in love with her, I've been watching this movie for 20 years. I never understand that. I never understand why that becomes a major thing in the movie, other than the fact that it's supposed to get us to the end point where he lectures her in a scene that, I'm sorry, William Holden plays it beautifully. And I want to be very sincere about this. I think it's written really well. I think William Holden does a great job with it. But that scene is like, seriously, man, screw you. Like, yeah, there's such pleasure in, like, you see, you're pure television. And he does that whole, like, dramatic thing where he, like, acts it out, like, we're this type of genre, and then the credits roll and like that. It's like, gee, what it must have been like to have been before this era where television was just pure and good and wonderful. There's only one scene in the movie where I think it kind of calls, like, William Holden's character out on his bullshit, which is when Diana Christensen first meets him and says, like, I watched your newscast tonight. It had this element and this element and all these tawdry elements. So don't be acting like you're doing some sort of, like, you know, you're doing God's work or something. But I feel like the movie in general just doesn't see that. It's more about William Holden is right, Robert Duvall is wrong, Faye Dunaway is wrong, everybody who is, like, younger or cares about money is wrong. And, like, there's an argument to be made about, like, the news should not worry about profits. I mean, this is a movie that you agree with its overall agenda, but when it, like, gets into the specifics, you're like, it's not exactly like that. And then my last thing I have to say, the Black Panther stuff in this movie drives me absolutely crazy.
I mean, it's terrible.
It's terrible and it's cheap. And like that scene where they're negotiating over like the deal points has driven me crazy for like decades now, where I'm just like even as like as a stupid college kid. And listen, I'm not that much smarter now, but especially back then, it's like even back then I was like, this just seems kind of cheap and easy. And it seems incredibly insulting, honestly. And I know it's supposed to be a satire, it's supposed to be kind of making the point that in this day and age, everybody cares about their contracts. You know, money is such an object that even people who have hard thought principles will sacrifice them as long as they make sure that they get their residuals and stuff like that. I mean, I get the point of that joke, but again, it just feels like the white guy making fun of other people. That's just as entertaining as this movie is. The details of it, as is probably obvious to anybody listening, rub me the wrong way very, very deeply.
Okay, here is Grierson. This is a quote about Network. I want you to tell me who you think it's from.
Okay.
No predictor of the future, not even Orwell, has ever been as right as Chayefsky was when he wrote Network. Just make one guess of who you think said that.
Because it's his favorite movie of all time, I wonder if it was from Stephen Colbert.
It's not Stephen Colbert, but that's not a bad guess.
Thank you.
Aaron Sorkin. And it is not the least bit surprising that Aaron Sorkin loves the shit out of this movie. Every single thing that you have talked about how it pats itself on the back, and I agree with it in a larger sense, but every time everyone starts talking, this great man theory of history, this is, like, it feels like Sorkin built his whole career trying to make this movie, and we don't like this type of movie anymore.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up Mr. Sorkin, because while watching it this time, I thought a lot about Mr. Sorkin and also The Social Network. When he won his Oscar, he thanked Paddy Chayefsky from the podium when he got his Oscar. There are clear parallels. And who knows how Social Network will age over time, but I feel like that the Fincherness, and we've talked about this, not on this podcast, but you and I as friends have talked about this. I think what will help The Social Network is that movie, because of the David Fincher cold factor, that movie is a little bit less self-regarding than I think The Network is. And who knows? That movie is only about 6 or 7 years old, so there's still some obviously a lot more time to go. But I actually thought a lot about Social Network and felt like, I don't think that one's going to make me cringe quite as much as Network does. And at the same time, I do have to say this, like, it's really watchable and it's really fun. This movie like kind of zips along in this really great way. I think if anything, it starts to bog down in the second half when it stops being about what the hell's going on with Howard Beale and he's successful now and how are they going to handle it, when the plot more kicks in, like Diana Christensen takes over the network, and then she starts doing these other programs, and then, like, you know, William Holden gets fired, but he starts having the affair. All like the plot stuff is a lot less interesting than the kind of the central idea of what would happen if an anchor just like lost his mind on the air, and as opposed to it destroying his career, everybody starts watching. That's like a really great idea. I have to say also, I'm not going to quote from it, but one of my favorite all-time Pauline Kael reviews is her review of Network. She really hates this movie. Like, she just outright hates it. And I don't agree with everything that she says, but some of the stuff that you and I are talking about is definitely in there. And just the fact that I always think of this when I watch this movie, everybody yells in this movie all the time. I mean, they just, and it's like, you know, They live and work in a high pressure environment, and I get that. But this is one of those movies where after a while you're like, wow, everybody is yelling all of the time. I mean, you know, even Ned Beatty's scene, which is iconic and all of that, like, he's screaming a lot during that part as well. Like everybody sort of like out screams each other in this movie. So
the actors, it's like they have solos in a musical. Like, they have a little moment where, like, that's his, too. They're just like, okay, here's my yelling scene. So
yeah, yeah. As as Pauline Kael mentions in her review, you know, Beatrice Straight has her moments. She peaks and then she leaves the movie. Like everybody like has their scene and then they go away. Yeah, it's like, I know it's tough to talk about a movie like this, at least for me, because there is so much stuff that I enjoy, but I do find myself wanting to push against some of the incredible accolades it's gotten over time, because I do feel like, really? Like, did you watch this part of it recently and see how badly this part kind of doesn't hold up? And yeah.
And again, you know, just to, I do think there's an element of resonance to it now that might not have been there a year and a half ago, to be honest. Like, again, not just the idea of someone advocating their rage, but, like, I found myself writing down when I was watching it, like, wow, there's a moment where everybody stops and says, you're talking about putting a manifestly irresponsible man on national television.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, there's a lot of little moments like that where, like, we need someone to articulate our rage and this guy. And so there's a lot of that that I think does work and does speak to the weaknesses of a new medium sometimes in understanding and being able to harness its own power. I do think there is a little bit of that to it, but it just runs with it so far and just gets lost in all these other things. Listen, I still like Network and it does zing along, but to me, this is not, I'm not even sure it's in my top five favorite Sidney Lumet films, to be entirely honest.
Yeah, it's, and I have to say, while watching it this time, I did, you know, it's impossible, not just the Trump-ness of it, but also the idea of, I would love to know what it was like at the time when Ned Beatty does his speech about there are no countries, there are just corporations now. And now that feels like, yeah, I mean, that's not, it feels more like, that like that one guy at the party who also wants to chime in when people are discussing political things. And you're like, yeah, no, dude, we all kind of know that. That's not like a fresh insight. But at the time, I don't know if that was like a very visionary sort of thing. And also, I mean, listen, like in terms of how corporations have gobbled up networks and media and controlled those things, that's even more true now than it was back then. So it definitely did. I think in the grand scope of things, it has predicted a lot of things, unfortunately, but it's not unlike when you have someone in your life who's very angry about a lot of things. And a lot of times they're right. They're right about those things. But then they start, you go, yeah, yeah. And then they go, yeah, and this other thing. And you're like, well, hold on. Well, you know, it's not really her fault. And women are not, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, maybe you shouldn't say that in public, you know, that sort of thing. It does have a little bit of that, but,
All right. So in other words, Cruise Elite say Network sucks.
Yes, that sucks. Definitely the takeaway. Yes.
All right, so that was fun. That was good. I was glad. I was afraid you were going to leave me hanging there to be like, no, Will, this is a classic and you're a moron. So.
I was about ready to say, for our longtime listeners who love it when we disagree, prepared to once again be disappointed because, yeah, we do. Because we got to realize that just really fast, you and I have really never talked about Network, so I really didn't know how you felt about. It is a movie, just to say real fast, that like a lot of people really love and really take it personally in a certain way. I have to say, like, it resonates with them in a way where I always feel uncomfortable bringing up my reservations because it really feels like I'm kicking their child, honestly. But I guess we kicked the child today. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much Sorkin in this thing, man. I mean, it really feels like Sorkin for this. And my thoughts about Sorkin, I think, are well documented. All right. So that is Network. Thank you for giving us this classic movie that we have trashed down. All right. So our final reboot section this week is The Royal Tenenbaums.
There were three extraordinary children in the Tenenbaum family.
I should sell it. Yeah.
Chaz Tenenbaum was a financial expert and started buying real estate in his early teens. Margot Tenenbaum was an acclaimed playwright and won a Pulitzer Prize in the ninth grade. Richie Tenenbaum was a champion tennis player ranked second in the world by age 17. They were brilliant. They were famous. They were unlucky enough to be the children of a man named Royal Tenenbaum.
Royal Tenenbaums came out around Christmas time, 2001. It is the third feature film from director Wes Anderson, who co-wrote it with his buddy Owen Wilson, who has a part in the movie. It is about the Tenenbaum family that lives in New York. They had three children who were all seemingly just child prodigies and were all destined for amazing, great things. But then something happened along the way to all three of them. The movie comes to is basically the present time as Gene Hackman, who plays the father, Royal Tenenbaum, who's been estranged from the rest of his family for quite some time, decides to impose himself back on the family once he finds out that his wife, they're actually not divorced, they're just separated. His wife, played by Angelica Houston, is seriously considering a marriage proposal from her accountant, played by Danny Glover. Gene Hackman doesn't want that, and so he goes back into their lives, saying that he has cancer and only has weeks to live. The three kids are played by Ben Stiller, Luke Wilson, and Gwyneth Paltrow, whose character Margot is actually adopted because Royal always mentions that at every occasion. We had this whole conversation about network and the struggles I've had entirely embracing that movie as much as other people do. It's kind of well paired with the Royal Tenenbaums because, well, I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I'm more of a second half Wes Anderson fan than I am a first half Wes Anderson fan. I think his more recent films have been the best things that he has done. A lot of people love the Royal Tenenbaums, though, and so I was really curious to watch it again because it had been a few years. And I have to say that I have sort of a different relationship with this movie now. I'm not sure if it's because I've gotten older or I've become more fond of Wes Anderson's movies or whatever. I do like it a little bit more than I remember when it came out at the time. I still think it's a bit too cutesy and precious, which is a weird thing to say about any Wes Anderson movie because that's kind of what you're buying when you purchase a ticket for one of his movies. But I don't think that the construction of some of these characters entirely work. I don't necessarily think that the narrator, the fact that this is supposed to be a book, essentially, that we're watching on film, always works. There's such a fine line with Wes Anderson's movies where sometimes the preciseness of how they're put together is, I think, really marvelous, like, say, Fantastic Mr. Fox or The Grand Budapest Hotel, which I think are really, really tremendous movies. This one is not quite to the level of that because I think it's a little too dollhousey in certain ways. I want to kind of start off with that because I think we both have a lot to talk about in terms of this movie. I think this is one of his very good ones. It's not one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I'm generally with you on the second half stuff with Anderson, though I am a much bigger fan of Rushmore than you are. I feel like Rushmore has an emotional component I think really clicks. And there's stuff in this. I find myself, though, even with his later movies, the ones I think work really well, I still often find, you know, we joked a little bit about Grand Budapest Hotel, which I think, is that your favorite Wes Anderson movie? Or if it's a Fantastic Mr. Fox?
Fantastic Mr. Fox is still my favorite, yeah.
Okay, but they're right. You're very fond of both of those movies.
I'm very fond of both, yeah.
And I like both of those movies too, but there's still, you know, one of the things that I find myself missing a little bit, even from Bottle Rocket, which we talked about this podcast, which now the ones we're crazy about, but I like, one of the things that fun tensions I have in Wes Anderson movies are to try to almost watch his careful, meticulous construction of everything and to watch sometimes life, like raw, messy, ugly real life, try to claw its way out from it a little bit. And to me, the great thing about Royal Tenenbaums, a movie that does, I agree with a lot of what you say, but the great thing about it is Gene Hackman's performance. Gene Hackman is, it's funny, he almost doesn't feel comfortable being in a Wes Anderson movie. You can almost, there's that kind of, just his natural, the way he kind of has a little bit of that Paul Newman, like just natural inherent comfort on camera that is sometimes, you know, you see a lot of the other actors being very sure that, like, am I doing this the way that Wes wants? I'm in a Wes Anderson movie. I'm acting in a Wes Anderson movie. I have to be very, very specific about what he wants me to do. And Gene Hackman is so, and of course, part of this is in the construct of the character. His character's supposed to be a little outside of their little world too. But to watch Gene Hackman in this movie, fighting it is too strong of a word, because I think he is down with the vision of what's going on, but it's so fun to just him, and I think Angelica Houston, frankly, to a little bit lesser extent, to watch them bring real life and a kind of dirt, like the messiness of real life into a Wes Anderson movie is a really fascinating subplot to the movie, to watch him do that. I love Gene Hackman in this movie, and it's funny because, you know, I watched a large part of this movie, and it does feel like there are, like, Ben Stiller is not quite right, and he doesn't quite nail it, and but yet that their relationship is built up enough to a moment at the end, and really the payoff for their relationship just really got me. I didn't remember it getting me before, you know, when they have that moment after Owen Wilson has his big crash and he says, I've had a really hard year. And he's like, I know you have. And it kind of knocked me over in a way that even when I really like Wes Anderson movies, and I think they're better ones than this one, haven't got me in that way. And that really snuck up on me. I remember the scene, I'd seen the movie, but I was really, and I think so much of that is what Hackman does. He's just kind of laying little seeds of humanity throughout and really kind of building up to a really powerful moment like that I think really works. And I think carrying Ben Stiller into the moment a little bit too. As for the movie itself, obviously Wes Anderson in music in his movies, people have written whole books about music in Wes Anderson's movies. I feel like of all of his movies, this is the one where the music does the most work. There are times where you feel that the music is really trying to provide emotional moments and to give momentum as opposed to going along with what's actually happy. And I feel like he gets that right eventually as his career goes along. But I do think there's a little bit of that in this movie where it's like, okay, here's the big sequence and here's a big moment. And the last thing before going respond to everything I'm saying here, because I have said a lot of things. Luke Wilson, I think, is a fine actor, but this is a similar character to kind of what he plays in Bottle Rocket. And I have less patience for that specific kind of, I am so tortured because of love or the world is really hard or emotions, than perhaps I might have 15 years ago.
That's so interesting. I was about ready to say I was nodding my head along to everything you said, except for the last thing.
Part. Right.
Yeah, because I actually I didn't listen to very much of it, but I listened to a little bit of the commentary track just to hear Wes Anderson kind of talk about the movie, because I was sort of curious. And he said at one point that the two characters that he probably most relates to in the movie are Luke Wilson and Gwyneth Paltrow's characters. And I just watched the movie and I was listening to this commentary track, and I thought, yeah, that makes sense, because they're my two favorite. That's my favorite relationship. I shouldn't say they're my favorite characters, because I agree with you. I think Gene Hackman in this movie and Ralph Fiennes in Grand Budapest Hotel are probably my two favorite creations in the Wes Anderson world. But that relationship between Gwyneth Paltrow and Luke Wilson really gets me, more so than his character in Bottle Rocket. And to your general point, what I have either come to understand or finally get that maybe everybody else already knew about Wes Anderson's movies is I do think that there is this kind of great tension in them between how precise and meticulous their design is and how emotionally messy the characters' lives actually are. And to work backwards in things that you said, that line that Ben Stiller says to Gene Hackman, I have never forgotten it, because for me, I actually saw this movie. I remember I saw it like right before it came out. So it was like early December of 2001. You know, 9/11 had just happened. I had just had a really terrible breakup around the same time. And so when that line happened, there was an extra whammy for me where he said, I've just had a really hard year. And, you know, my personal stuff aside, I think a lot of people felt that way in 2001. And I remember being in the audience and sort of hearing the audience kind of go, when they heard it, because it was like, it was clearly not meant to, it could not have anticipated that, but it was such a moment where it's like, God, we did kind of have a bad year. And the fact that Gene Hackman says, I know you did, there is something incredibly kind in that moment. And I agree with you. I think you put it really beautifully about Gene Hackman is too much the, like, gruff 70s actor guy to entirely go into this, like, you know, you have to talk this way in the movie, and you have to be this way about it. Like, I think Angelica Houston actually does kind of fit into the model really well. Even, like, later actors, like when Ed Norton started coming into these movies, it's like, oh, they're doing the Wes Anderson thing. Gene Hackman doesn't entirely do it, and it's great. And, I've seen interviews that the cast and crew have done since the movie came out, talking about, like, Gene Hackman was kind of, not, I don't want to say a jerk, but he was kind of tough on Wes Anderson. He was also, this was really early in Wes Anderson's career. And I think the impression I was left with that Gene Hackman was kind of like, who is this kid? What's his deal? Like, I don't think they necessarily like entirely got along. And you can kind of feel that tension maybe a little bit. I mean, people will ask Wes Anderson, like, you got to get Gene Hackman out of retirement. You've got to put him in another movie. And Wes Anderson's always said, like, I've tried and other people have tried. And he just, you know, he is happily retired. He is writing books now and he's just living in New Mexico and living his life and he doesn't want to act anymore. He made like one other movie, that Welcome to Mooseport movie, but this is a great like final movie for Gene Hackman. I also agree with you about the music. I think some of the music cues are fabulous in this, but it does feel like the model of early Wes Anderson, which is take this rock song. One of the things actually I think is part of the reason why I like his more recent movies is they've actually had the scores from Alexander Desplat, which I think I feel like they create a universe as opposed to going, hey, here's a Van Morrison song that's awesome. Here's a John Lennon song that's great. Or here's a version of a Beatles song done in a different way. And I like those songs, but they definitely feel more of a time of that 90s period of taking, you know, again, the Tarantino model, obviously, or even like going back to Scorsese of let's take rock songs, let's put them in this way and see how like what emotional thing kind of comes from it. My final thing, and I want you to talk since I've talked a bunch now, as much as I think Wes Anderson sometimes gets criticized for maybe being, you know, the stuff we're talking about, too dollhousey, it's all kind of an artificial construction. He pulls off something I think that's very difficult to do in this movie, which is film a suicide, which I actually think, I know you don't like the Luke Wilson character as much. So I'd be curious how you feel about this. I find it very effective. I find it very emotional. And we just talked about use of rock songs. I think the Elliott Smith song is incredibly effective. Now I can't hear that song without thinking of the scene in this movie. And that's not, it's not done glibly. I think it's actually done very, very well. And there's a real kind of emotional oomph where I understand what has driven that character to do what he does.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's really less, I think that scene's done very well. I think, yeah, I like Luke Wilson in this role, and I don't think anybody's bad in the movie. I actually probably, to me, you know, both those characters, it's not surprising to me what Wes Anderson would say those are the ones that he feels closest to. There are also ones that, frankly, I feel like he may have grown out of a little bit as he's gotten older, which I think is a positive thing for his career. Like, I think that a positive thing for his films. There's less, like, that the disaffected youth thing, sometimes, to me, that can be a little off-putting when you're in this kind of a dollhouse environment. I think, and maybe that's just me getting older, because I did not feel that way when I saw this movie the first time. But there's a little bit, I'll say this, the kids in the movie are actually not, like, I know that they're emotional thrust of the movie, and I think they're all fine. I think everybody's good in the roles. But I do find myself, I mean, maybe it's just because Gene Hackman is so magnetic in this movie, but I find myself often wanting to get back to them. I have to say, very briefly, too, Bill Murray, I like, this is a very quiet Bill Murray that I really enjoyed. He got a little louder in Wes Anderson movies as he went along. This is a very quiet Bill Murray that I actually very much liked. And but it's also a very loud Owen Wilson, in a way I also did enjoy. Like, Owen Wilson is every once in a while just shows up and just like blows the movie up for a second and then leaves in a way that that kept me incredibly entertained as we went around.
Yeah, it's funny because I do feel like Bill Murray's character is one of the creations in the movie that feels a lot less lifelike. I mean, both him and Ben Stiller's character, I think, are kind of hamstrung by, yeah, they're just this, like, thing. I mean, in this commentary track, Wes Anderson mentions that Bill Murray's character is sort of inspired by Oliver Sacks, which is interesting. But that part of the movie, I find myself being a little less interested in. Owen Wilson, my one reservation about Owen Wilson is that I feel like they allow his character to get out of rehab essentially so that he can put the family in peril at the end of the movie. Like, it's a little, that doesn't entirely work for me. The other thing I want to ask you, and maybe I'm just, you know, whatever, but I love Alec Baldwin as the narrator. Let me just say that first. I think he's great. He just nails it. It's just so, such a perfectly done thing. When they cut to the chapters of the book, why are the chapters written as if they're scene descriptions in a screenplay? I don't know. I never really like paid attention until this time. I'm like, wait, I don't get why. I didn't listen to the commentary track enough. Maybe Wes Anderson explains that. But there was a part of it that's like, wait, this is like no way, the way no book has ever been written. And it didn't make any. And because he's so meticulous, I was confused to the decision to do it. If there was ever like a terrible Q&A question from an audience for Wes Anderson, that would be what I would do. Like, yes, in Royal Tenenbaums, why are the chapters written like screenplay scene descriptions? And I love your work. And he would walk out and like curse my name and like that. But
I think it's kind of funny though. It was fun to watch because I thought something similar. But I kind of like the idea that like, okay, I'm gonna see this. The beginning of this chapter is gonna tell me what Gene Hackman is about to do. And now I get to watch Gene Hackman's interpretation of that. Like, it was almost like an acting exercise. It was like it was Royal walks through a side door and looks pensive. And then I watched Gene Hackman do it. I was like, all right, now I see how Gene Hackman interpreted that set of scene decoration.
Yeah, you know, people of course know that we're big Woody Allen fans. I have to say, especially because of the novelistic quality of this movie, this one definitely feels like his Hannah and her sisters in a lot of ways. Maybe I hadn't noticed that so much before. But I even think like some of the literary into cinematic kind of thing that he's doing in this, I think works better in Grand Budapest Hotel, which I think is more kind of built into the storytelling.
I think he's just a more comfortable filmmaker now, to be entirely honest.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I mean, we talked about the showiness of Network a bunch. This movie is also kind of showy, and it's not that Wes Anderson's movies in general aren't, but I find myself more noticing it, or more kind of announcing itself, for whatever reason, in this movie. I think, also while watching this, I was reminded again, I know there are reasons why I'm not supposed to like Gwyneth Paltrow, like, I understand that, but I like Gwyneth Paltrow on screen. Like, I like her as an actress, and I know that there's outside stuff. You know, her talking about when Trump wins the election and says, like, I'm so excited because the opportunities or whatever it's, you know, for chaos or whatever it is that she said, that's annoying. And her, like, lifestyle brand, I get, is annoying. But her on screen, I really like. And I really like her in this. And also, Danny Glover is fabulous in this movie. And I feel like he tends not to get as much attention when people talk about this movie. But I really, he is so incredibly sweet, but at the same time, like, he's no dummy. He knows what's going on. And I love watching that character kind of like figure it out and kind of get a certain amount of enjoyment in watching, Royal get his comeuppance once it's sort of, he's exposed and all of that. Again, like Network, this is a massively, massively watchable film. It works really, really nicely. It's been constructed really, really well. But it's not one that is on the top of my list in terms of Mr. Anderson movies.
Which is not a bad place to be, because I feel like watching this, And, you know, I like Grand Budapest Hotel more than Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think he's and I was really fond of that. And I feel like the last two or three, I'm generally with you on that. And I think that is exposed even more. I'm very curious, actually, to go back and watch Rushmore, which is a movie I'm very fond of, to see. Because watching this, I'm like, man, this is really good. But he was really going to get this better in like 10 or 12 years. And I think he does.
Yeah, and you know, his great subject is families, and this is probably the most family. Well, I want to say the most family-ish because I think a lot of his movies have that, but
it's the most self-consciously family.
Yeah, and I think it does kind of the fact that those people still can't help themselves but feel something for Royal, even though he is an absolute bastard. It connects in a way, the way that we have about our parents. I think the movie does understand that and kind of taps into that in a very nice way.
All right, so that is The Royal Tenenbaums. Thank you for putting that in our reboot. That was I have to say I like Royal Tenenbaums more than I like Network. But even though I had so a few issues with each of these movies, very entertaining. Very glad to be able to go back and watch both of them. Very enjoyable stuff. All right, that is our show for this week. Grierson, good show. Nailed it again. We did it perfect every single time.
65 out of 65.
Well, 63 out of 65. You missed two of them, so you don't get to say 65. 65. I've been here every day, Chris.
I've been carrying your ass this entire. Yes.
All right. So we have one movie to discuss, a new movie that is to discuss next week. The big release next week is The Circle. The Circle, starring Emma Watson, Tom Hanks, John Boyega, Patton Oswalt, and in his last film role, Bill Paxton. Bill Paxton in his last film role. Bless his heart. I like me some Bill Paxton. This, of course, is written and directed by James Ponsoldt, a director we have enjoyed very much, who did The Spectacular Now, filmed here in Athens, Georgia, and also The End of a Tour, which Grierson liked more than I did, but I also thought was fine. I'm excited to see this movie, of course, based off the very successful, very enjoyable Dave Eggers novel. Tom Hanks now almost exclusively doing movies based off of Dave Eggers' books.
He has like a 6-picture deal with Dave Eggers.
Him and Dave. All right, so we'll be discussing The Circle next week. Then we have two reboot movies. The first reboot movie we will be doing next week is A Streetcar Named Desire. Of course, directed by Eli Kazan, came out in 1951, starring Vivian Leigh, Marlon Brando, Carl Malden. It's based off a Tennessee Williams play. I think that's right.
That is correct.
Okay, yeah, Tennessee, strange name, Williams. Thank you for giving me that.
Nodding encouragingly.
Thank you very much, Frank. Okay, so Streetcar Named Desire, of course, most famous for inspiring The Room. And our
that final, is not, hold on, that, go ahead.
This, okay, it's one of, at least one of the three reasons it's most famous. And our final reboot movie next week is A History of Violence, which came out in 2005, directed by David Cronenberg, starring Viggo Mortensen, Maria Bello, William Hurt. People loved that movie when it came out, Grierson. You and I were a little more skeptical about it, but I'm excited to kind of dig back in. I'm done, Grierson. Have a great week. I'm sorry I did this. Have a great time. We will be back next week with A History of Violence, A Streetcar Named Desire, and The Circle. See you, Grierson.
May we end every episode with, I'm sorry I did this.
I am. I really do. Let's just call it that.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye. I don't know why. Oh, I don't know.